Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what highlights might 2013 bring? We'll explore with Sarah Van Gelder. Then we spend the rest of the hour discussing a disturbing trend of increasing numbers of school children being conditioned for the criminal justice system. What might it mean for society, and how should this situation be addressed? Last year brought many vital issues out into the open. Storms such as Hurricane Sandy, for example, heightened awareness of climate change. What might we see develop in 2013? With us is Sarah Van Gelder. She is editor of Yes magazine, and her latest column addresses this question. Welcome, Sarah Van Gelder.
I'm so glad to be here.
2012 was a pretty tumultuous year, and it seems to be pointing to some new changes for 2013. So you just wrote a piece in your publication, Yes, about what the 9 key trends are. Let's start with the climate crisis.
The summer of drought that led to more than half of the counties in the United States being declared disaster zones. Here in the West, the wildfires, and then, of course, Superstorm Sandy. All of that really brought home to people that climate change isn't something that's going to happen to some future generation or someplace else. It's going to happen right here, and it's happening right now. And this is the moment, if there is one, when we can still avert real catastrophe. So I think this is the number one story for this year, is the question of what we will do about it now that 4 out of 5 Americans are aware that this is a serious problem.
Just a couple of years ago, the number of people who said climate change was a serious problem had fallen down to something like 40%. I think this was 2009. I assume that was partly because of the rhetoric that people were hearing in the echo chamber of Fox News and the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, the New York Post, and the denial, especially after ClimateGate. Do you think that those audiences are disbelieving their media now? Do you think they're coming around?
I think you nailed it in terms of what brought down the level of understanding of the climate crisis. What's happened is a lot of people have seen that what the scientists predicted would happen is in fact happening. They can see it with their own eyes. They experience these, 100-degree-plus days or weeks. They see the crops that they've been trying to raise withering in the field, the floods, and certainly these big storms. So I think the people who weren't inclined to believe what 97-98% of scientists say are believing their own eyes, and that's bringing the numbers back up to pretty much the highest level that they've been at in the United States.
You noted in your article that the Obama administration had not really done a big legislative piece yet, partly because of the congressional resistance. We know, of course, through the stimulus, he really did kickstart the renewable energy industry. So we saw some things in the policy world, but you said you also were enthusiastic about what was happening in some of the local levels.
Old big energy corporations seem set on making sure that they get a full return on their investment in the old dirty energy economy. From the point of view of everybody else, that's a disastrous policy. And Bill McKibben is one of the people who's pointed that out so eloquently in his Rolling Stone article about what would happen if we do, in fact, burn up all that fossil fuel, what it will do to our planet, what it will do to the possibilities that our children and their children will have any sort of stable world in which to try to make a living. The resistance, I think, is showing that the American people are out of in front of their government once again. And the resistance is coming from students who are inspired by this movement Bill McKibben and the 350.org have launched, which is to convince colleges and universities to divest their holdings in these big, dirty energy corporations. And it's coming from landowners who don't want to see the KXL pipeline go through their land. And so they're literally blockading that and doing civil disobedience. And it's coming from Native people, especially in Canada, who are standing up to the tar sands and the KXL pipeline plans. It's coming here in the Northwest from people who don't want to see coal transported through our state to ports for export to China. And certainly in Appalachia, where there's been so much protest of mountaintop removal, this dirty energy business has such awful repercussions for people who are right there where that energy extraction and transportation is happening. And then it has these terrible implications for our whole planet. And people at the grassroots seem to be at the forefront of really stepping up to that.
The second big trend you noted was really about the change in political power and political policy that relates to people of color. What do you see happening in 2013?
Let me just say what happened in 2012, which is we had a presidential election in which it appears that the Republican Party thought they could win by appealing to white males with policies that were actually detrimental to almost everyone else. And maybe that could have won in the past. But at this point, the clout and the numbers of people of color is growing, and they refuse to be shut out of the voting process in spite of all sorts of discriminatory voter suppression tactics. They showed up at the polls and, in fact, in many cases, waited many hours in line to make sure they could vote. And, of course, women were just outraged by the candidates who were discussing rape in such cavalier ways and were suggesting that binders of women were the solution to equalizing women's rights. When you put those numbers together, that's the majority of Americans. So the old Republican Party tactic of mainly appealing to white men simply isn't working for them, and I think they're realizing it, which means that they're pretty much in disarray. There are a number of them saying we are going to have to, against their own wishes, perhaps press for immigration reform. We're going to see that on the agenda very soon. And other aspects of their platform is going to have to be more inclusive if they hope to win elections outside of those particular districts where they're especially strong. So I think we're going to see the Republican Party really trying to reinvent itself to be more inclusive in 2013. But the interesting challenge is going to be that so much of their rhetoric up to now has been excluding the rights of women and people of color. So will they be able to hold on to their base and become more inclusive? I think that's going to be really interesting to watch.
The third trend that you noted dealt with finally addressing the issues related to gun violence.
It's been a year of some really tragic mass shootings. The widespread availability of guns, I mean, this gun show loophole that allows pretty much anyone to walk into a gun show and purchase a weapon, there are really no safeguards. The good news is that not only do a majority of Americans support a ban on assault weapons, but actually the number of American households that own guns is lower than it used to be. It's just that the households that do own weapons tend to have more of them. So we've seen a lot of reports on the spike in gun buying, but there's actually not more households owning guns. But we also have people who are mentally unstable, who have very little difficulty getting a hold of weapons if they choose to, and we have a culture that just has so awash in images of righteous violence that it's very easy for somebody who's a bit unstable to pick that up as the way that you express your anxiety and your anger. I think that people's hearts were broken by the Sandy Hook elementary school shootings, and now you hear people who in the past felt that they absolutely could not stand up to the NRA. Now people are, in fact, willing to say, you know, this has just gone too far. I don't think there's going to be any question of the Second Amendment being overturned, but I do think that Americans are ready for something that's a little bit more reasonable, a little bit closer to what we see in other industrialized countries.
Unless, of course, the Supreme Court maintains its stance, which it has done so far to date and even hardened it in its last few decisions. Number four, we could probably just cover really quickly, that deals with the U.S. global military and how much blowback we've been seeing as a result of it. What do you think 2013 will bring?
There's several different kinds of blowback that I think people are becoming very aware of. One is that more members of the armed services are killing themselves than are being killed by the enemy or being killed by any other means. So that's a really troubling number. You know, it shows the depth of the damage that we're actually inflicting on our own men and women in uniform by sending them over for multiple deployments and all the other things that are involved in sending young people into harm's way. It's interesting that you often see in Congress the people who've served in combat are often the most reluctant to send people into war. They understand just how horrific it is to be involved in that kind of violence and how horrific it is for everyone concerned. So we're seeing the blowback effects of that now on our own veterans and our own service members. The other thing is that the cost of maintaining a military that is larger than the next, I believe it's the next 10 or 15 countries combined, including most of our allies, Russia and China combined, that cost is bankrupting our budget. in order to purchase a military establishment that includes, you know, hundreds of military bases around the world, and it's all sorts of sophisticated weapons, some of which the Pentagon doesn't even want. That reality is finally coming to home to roost, and the notion that we might go back to 2006 levels of military spending, that would be some kind of a huge catastrophe, you know, which is basically the sort of level that was in the so-called fiscal cliff sequestration. That just isn't credible. I think most Americans realize that we can actually do just fine with more moderate spending.
One of the other really interesting developments was that the people of the Occupy Wall Street shifted into another form of activism.
Yeah, what an interesting fall. First, there was the strike debt, which is especially young people who are in thousands of dollars of debt because of going to college, but also people who got sick and ended up with enormous medical bills and debt, including people who had health insurance but didn't have enough health insurance to cover all the costs it takes to pay for some kind of a serious illness now. The amazing thing Occupy did is said, this is not your fault. This is a system that is systematically transferring wealth from the 99% to the 1% through these mechanisms of debt. And one of the things that they did is they started this rolling jubilee. They raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, and by leveraging it in the same way that collection agencies leverage debt, they were able to actually dissolve millions of dollars of medical debt. So that people have been getting letters now, people who are in enormous amounts of debt have been getting letters saying, your debt has been dissolved because Occupy raised the money and paid pennies to the dollar just the way collection agencies do and dissolved some of that debt. So that's one major thing. And then when Superstorm Sandy came along, they had all these networks throughout New York City from the days of their actual occupations. They had a lot of logistical knowledge. And so when the superstorm came along, they were able to launch an effort that involved thousands of volunteers throughout the most hard-hit neighborhoods. And they've been going in and supplying people with food and water and creating distribution centers and checking on people isolated at the top of, you know, high-rise housing projects, elderly people who didn't have elevator service because the power was out. They've climbed the staircases, you know, to find those people and make sure they were okay. So it's just been an amazing effort and quite inspiring. I actually had a chance to do some volunteer work with them on Thanksgiving Day, and I was so impressed.
Are they making it clear that they are the same people of Occupy Wall Street?
Well, yeah. Of course, it's not all the same people. It's amorphous because they'll go into a neighborhood and set up a distribution center, but a lot of the volunteers will be people who are actually from that neighborhood who get involved once their own immediate issues are handled. So it's a very, very permeable boundary. And I do want to understand better, how do we help each other out? What kind of a world do we want that's the one that's more cooperative and one where we look for ways to work together, not one where we literally sink or swim on our own?
After Citizens United decision, 2012 ended up becoming a year of a backlash against it, even with the president supporting a constitutional amendment to overturn it. And to add to that, now you've pointed that out, even though there were so much money spent and disproportionate amount of money spent in that presidential election, we really didn't see all of that extra money on the Republican side made that big of an impact.
Someone could go through and assess some of the House races and the local and state races, and they might come out with an analysis that would show where that money did show up. But in terms of the presidential race, we did have President Obama prevail, of course, and you know, and he was spending a lot of that kind of money as well. So regardless of whether the Republicans or the Democrats win, I think we could say the 1% win when both candidates have to rely on them for their fundraising, which means there's some kinds of proposals, the ones that Wall Street doesn't like, that they will have a very difficult time proposing in their campaigns, and they'll have a very difficult time enacting if they want to be able to see their party prevail.
The last thing I really wanted to get to before we let you go was how far we've come in equality of marriage and where you see that going in 2013.
It is quite remarkable because even though other states have enacted gay marriage before now, this is the first year that it was done by a popular vote. So here in Washington State, where Yes Magazine is located, it was one thing to have the vote go in the direction of supporting gay marriage, but I was just stunned at the outpouring of love and celebration and just this ecstatic excitement, not only in the gay community, but in the straight community, that we had gotten this thing done. So when the first day that gay couples could get married in Washington State, the mayor opened City Hall at midnight so that they could have nonstop weddings from from midnight plus 1 minute on throughout the day. They had, you know, nonstop weddings going on simultaneously. And then during the day, there are all these people who gathered on the steps of City Hall to just celebrate and cheer on the couples as they came out of City Hall having just gotten married. And I saw absolutely no backlash. I saw no people with signs. You know, I'm sure there was some place people were writing nasty notes. It was just such a moment.
Well, Sarah Van Gelder, thank you so much for being with us. Now, if people wanted to go back and read your article about 2013, would you give us a website?
Sure. It's www.yesmagazine.org.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. And I'm Maria Armudian. We spend the rest of the hour discussing a disturbing trend of increasing numbers of school children being conditioned for the criminal justice system. What might it mean for society, and how should the situation be addressed? We turn now to Kim Socha, regional director for the organization Save the Kids, which works particularly with youth in the criminal justice system in mentoring, teaching, and helping them find new ways of engaging with others. Welcome, Kim Socha.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about school children ending up in the justice system rather than in the schools. Do you have some sense of how large this problem is and how it's changed over time?
It is a problem that's really existed since school integration, and it's something that has only increased probably since the 80s in the war on drugs, when more individuals from urban communities were being convicted of drug-related crimes. And drugs, of course, had a very negative impact in inner cities throughout the United States as well. So it's at that time that there were, as the prison population started to grow, this, what is commonly referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline, was also established, where, let's say in certain situations, a child, if something happened at school and he or she got in trouble, it would be something that the administration of the school would take care of, maybe the parents would be called. But what began to happen was, and it's happening more and more, is police officers are called in, there's actually security on campus, and then that developed into metal detectors on campus and things such as that. And it started to ramp up very noticeably with the war on drugs in, let's say, the late 70s, early 1980s. I know that for the state where I currently live, and that's in Minnesota, about 40% of African-American youth aren't graduating from high school, and a very large percent of them are winding up in the criminal justice system in some way, either in juvenile detention facilities or headed to adult detention facilities.
The program that you're involved with, called Save the Kids, is trying to teach children how to use nonviolent methods.
There's a lot of organizations out there that are dealing with preventative issues, which is wonderful, and we support that and take part in that as well. But really, our main focus is on kids who are already in the juvenile justice system. So what we do is try to do some group building activity and work with them once they've already entered the criminal justice system. So we'll go into juvenile detention centers. I go in to the adult detention center in Hennepin County in Minnesota, which does house youth ages 16 to 18. So we'll work with them on afternoons as part of their school program. And then with the juvenile detention center of Hennepin County, and again, Save the Kids is national. I'm just talking about what I'm doing regionally. They'll kind of go in and do these activities and talk to the youth about what got them there, but try to also have play games and do fun things, offer different ideas and alternatives to acting out violently. And sometimes that can happen just through discussion. It can happen through a game of, you know, we have tons of games that we play, like a game of tag or something like that.
I noticed a number of the projects. One called HIP, Help Increase the Peace Project, several of them including a poetry project, workshops on bullying. Give us a sense of what some of these are.
HIP is actually a program of the American Friends Service Committee. So when we go in and hold the workshops, we use all of their different activities. And that could be anything from role-playing games to trying to keep a ball up in the air for a certain amount of hits and things like that, and setting up different games. What's unique to Save the Kids is we have a poetry journal called Poetry Behind the Walls. There's been about 4 or 5 issues that have been published, and it gives youth the opportunity to express themselves through artwork, poetry, narrative, rap lyrics, and to know that their work will actually be published and read by the community is often very exciting for them. And, you know, aside from that, it's simply just a way for them to be able to express themselves. And some of the most, I happen to be an English teacher, and some of the most, like, poignant and thought-provoking work comes from the minds of these. Legally, many of them are still considered children. Like, to look at it as these are not bad individuals. These are individuals who did one bad thing for reasons that are very complicated, and then there's social issues. And there's also a spoken word behind the walls, and that's something that is on hiatus right now, but we're trying to get started again, where youth have the opportunity to spit rhymes or read spoken word poetry, have it recorded, and then that CD becomes available. Just one other program is Wisdom Behind the Walls, in which adults who are incarcerated, some for life sentences, are trying to do meaningful work from the inside. So they will send us their poetry or their letters to youth, and we post it on a website so that even these men who can't reach the kids directly because they're incarcerated, they still have that opportunity to say something to them, which can be very powerful as well.
And philosophically, the kind of Q&A parts of the workshops I found kind of interesting, for example, questioning the morality of using violence to deal with violence.
Exactly.
What is the response to it, and have you noticed a meaningful change as a result of these kinds of conversations?
I mean, meaningful change is something that's, it can be very hard to gauge because what so often happens, for example, I'm working in the adult detention center, and a lot of these individuals are going to prison. So they're in jail, and they're going to prison for long sentences. A lot of follow-up can't be done when that happens, but some of the conversations have most definitely worked. Actually, we're also very interested in mentoring and following up. So it's not just, oh, we'll do some workshops while these individuals are incarcerated and then kind of let them go. We want to maintain connection with them once they leave. Quite a few of them have stayed in touch. Some have even gone on in the New York area to become mentors to other youth. And then sometimes kids who have been through the system, you know, have a little bit more credibility than, let's say, somebody like me who looks like the average teacher that they're used to, you know, dealing with and maybe who they had problems with when they were in school. We've also, in the Twin Cities, have something as simple as taking one of the individuals out to lunch or dinner and making ourselves available. We've had some good experiences in that people are staying in touch, and so I'm hoping that that continues and we can start to have those youth mentor other individuals as well.
Kim Socha, Save the Kids, I think, might also get confused with Save the Children. So why don't you give us a website so people can check out your work on their own leisure time?
Let me just say that the organization itself was named by youth from Hillbrook Detention Center, from an individual who in New York. So this idea of saving, you know, we don't believe we're saving anyone, we're helping, but one of the kids actually named the group. But the website is www.savethekidsgroup.org.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle in the Insiders. I'm Maria Armodian. John Vang is with us now. He spent 8 years incarcerated, but now he volunteers as a mentor for others toward efforts to help their communities. Welcome, John Vang.
Thank you for having me.
You had some difficulties in your earlier experiences ending up in the justice system. What happened?
I think growing up, I was, like a lot of young kids these days, just trying to find who I was and what I stood for. And I found myself committing crimes, hanging out with the wrong crowd, doing drugs. And I got suspended a lot from school, started ditching school. And, you know, those are kind of the simple signs that everybody sees when kids start acting up. I mean, being suspended from school and all that stuff, I just was looking for help, and it was there. They couldn't find any help for me.
How old were you when you first started facing troubles in school?
I was one of those straight-A kids, but then my parents got divorced, and around that time I was 13, 14, 15, early teens.
As you were struggling in school and you were looking for help, you weren't finding the help, what did the school do and what did the community do?
I kept on getting in-school suspension and getting suspended from school. They passed me on to a counselor, but the counselor, all she really did was just kind of spoke to me and then my mom and sat us down. We kind of talked, spoke with the principal, but then whatever I was needing or looking for at that point, I could not find there. And, you know, I just returned right back to the guys that, like, got me involved in crime and gangs. And I just chose that path and I just went with it, you know.
For how long?
I was going on that path for, like, about 4 years. 4 or 5 years until I was maybe 18 or 19.
And when you're 18 or 19, is that when you had your first scuffle with the law, or had it already happened?
Actually, yeah, it had already happened when I was, I think, 14. Started ditching school, got caught up for truancy. Around 15, I started stealing cars. After that, I was shoplifting, and then I got involved into, like, gang fights, and police would stop me, and the gang task force would pull us over and just take pictures of us. And for us, that was kind of like a badge of honor, like, hey, you know, they got me in the book now. You know, they got my picture. I'm somebody now.
This was primarily through the juvenile system, right?
Yeah, juvenile system. I was on probation. I'm having problems with my mom. They sent me away to the group home, and the group home didn't really do much for us.
How old are you now?
I am 31 now.
When did you get out of the justice system?
I am still currently a part of the justice system. I did about 8 years for murder, and I'm still on parole until 2016.
Now you are mentoring other people who have gone through the system.
Yeah. During these last couple of years, I kind of encountered two programs that really, really pieced it all together for me and helped me find myself and started me on the right path towards becoming a leader and being active in the community. One of them was the Alternatives to Violence Project, and the other one was the Power of People Leadership Institute, which had a program called Power of People Personal Self-Development Program. I've been out about 7, 8 months now, and I'm hit the ground running, got involved with different community activism groups and nonprofit groups. I was fortunate enough to find a part-time job with the Alternatives to Violence Project, leading their support group for men and women who are coming out of prison.
What was it about these projects that you think essentially turned you into a community leader that wanted to make a contribution?
A lot of times when you're incarcerated, you feel like the world has forgotten about you, like you're a lost cause. Nobody wants to come in and see you, and they just want to hide you in a little box in the corner, in the closet somewhere. AVP, the Alternatives to Violence Project, they have a lot of volunteers that come in, and they lead these workshops. These people take time out of their lives to come in and speak to us and talk to us like people and treat us like people. And it's good because it shows that somebody still cares. And that was like one of the biggest steps for me to see that I am still a worthy cause, that I am still a valuable person. And just that really opened the doors for me to see my own personal worth. And then later on, I got involved with the Power of People group. That was powerful because it allowed me to reflect upon my past and take a deep look at all the painful things that had happened to me to make me who I am and the reasons why I chose to make the decisions that I made that led me to prison, and that for me to discover my own personal worth, to know that I am powerful, I am valuable, I'm important.
And in terms of the victims of the crimes that people commit, is there any communication with them?
They have several different programs that are open those doors, because for us as the people that commit the crimes, for us to contact the victims is not always a good thing, because some victims or the victims' families do not want to be contacted. But they have programs where you can write your letter and you put it out there, and if the victim should ever want to contact you or find out if you had written a letter, then they can get a hold of you. There was one instance, one of the Power of People guys, where the mother contacted them, and her son was murdered by this young man. And years later, after they both went through their turmoil, they found the strength and the courage to confront the other person and find out what their side of the story was. And they live right next door to each other, and they support each other. They go around to different venues, and they speak about this, about how people can forgive and move on and grow from it.
Did you have any experiences like that yourself?
I am open to those experiences, but I am not sure of the other side, because I have caused a lot of pain for my victim and his family. I don't know if they want to contact and want anything to do with me. All I can do is just do what I can for the community, and if that day should come, I would welcome it and express my remorse.
You said there's a social entrepreneurship project at the Power to the People?
Power of People is a group that is started by Dr. Verna Cornelia Price. She wrote a book, and then her husband, Shane Price, went into the prisons, and they are empowering these men of all ages to take back their life, to take back their power, and take their life in a positive direction. So since I've been out, I've been working on a social entrepreneur project with them to give ex-felons the opportunity to have a chance at life again, because a lot of times when they get out, you know, nobody really wants to give them a job or take the risk. And we found that, you know, if we could create this job and this business that can employ them, then that would be the step that they need to take their life in a positive direction, because nobody wants to give them the chance, and that's definitely not helping anybody out.
Have you got some projects that are already started?
We are in the process of looking for funding, and also in the process of taking inventory of the men's skills, so that we can kind of figure out, like, all right, you know, here's what we would be good at. A lot of guys have a lot of entrepreneurial ideas as they're sitting in there, and we're building upon that and trying to take that to the next level.
John Vanga, thank you so much for sharing your story and being with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to share my story and just be a part of what you guys are doing.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues, and I'm Maria Armudian. At the end of December, a committee at the U.S. Senate held hearings on the so-called school-to-prison pipeline, a phrase related to the conditioning and sending of schoolchildren into the criminal justice system. Children with behavioral problems are sometimes arrested, handcuffed, suspended, or expelled, which experts say merely exacerbates the problem. Simultaneously, many of these same schools have been starved of educational resources. Daniel Lowson is with us. He is the director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies, an initiative at the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Also with us is Anthony Nocella. He's a visiting professor in the School of Education and senior fellow of the dispute resolution at Hamline University and Hamline Law School, respectively. And Damian Schneider joins us also. He is a professor of African Studies at Scripps College. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I would like to start with Dan Lowson to try to understand this trend, how big it is, school kids landing into this justice system, and if you can quantify this.
A lot of people are unaware of just how many students are, for example, suspended out of school. And unfortunately, if you look nationally, kids who are suspended at least one time are over 3 million students. That's more than enough kids to fill every professional baseball and football stadium in America. And that is kids just suspended one or more times. It's not even getting at how many suspensions are meted out or how many days of lost instruction. And this is a real concern because we know that even being suspended one time doubles the risk of a kid not graduating on time. So there are tremendous negative academic repercussions, and then the racial disparities are just profound. So and also disability disparities, race and gender and disability. So for example, black students with disabilities, one out of every four, K through 12, were suspended at least once in 2009-10. So just a tremendous overuse. But the other piece of this is that there are many school districts across the country that are suspending very low numbers of kids, less than 3% of their total enrollment. So there is an alternative that is right there that exists in many school districts across the country. So there are some that are suspending huge numbers and some that are suspending very few.
And so what you're saying is that the type of punishment, the suspension, is actually feeding this pathway into...
I call it the school-to-prison pipeline when you think about it. Dropping out of school is one of the core predictors of whether kids will be involved in the juvenile justice system. Research report on Texas that tracked every middle school student in Texas for over 6 years found that being suspended just once dramatically increased the likelihood within a year that that student would be involved in the juvenile justice system. So that's one of the reasons we call it the school-to-prison pipeline, is because things like, you know, kicking kids out of school where they're left unsupervised is actually going to increase the risk of community crime, juvenile justice involvement, dropping out of school, all the things that we think we're trying to achieve by, you know, a lot of people say we're kicking the bad kids out so the good kids can learn. So their alternative is not just to leave kids who are disruptive in the classroom, but there are many, many alternatives that don't involve leaving kids unsupervised, that actually hold kids accountable and also bring more adults and kids together and pay attention and to try to really support the student, support the teachers, and find ways to keep that student in school and become successful.
Now, as I understand it, the suspension is just one of these kind of punishment models. I've read about things such as shackling kids and other kinds of extreme punishment that may also exacerbate that. Have you also looked at that?
Absolutely. And more what we're seeing is not only kids are being expelled, but in some districts I've looked at, we haven't looked at across the nation yet, but we are, it's increasingly common and often more likely than expulsion that a student is referred to law enforcement or arrested at school. So, for example, we have juvenile justices who have tried to work to push back against this and say to the school system, look, you're turning my courtroom into a principal's office. There are lots of offenses that should not be addressed by me, but really need to be taken care of by the principal. So part of the problem is that we have an infusion of more school resource officers, and many of them are not trained properly to work in an educational environment. They don't know anything about kids with disabilities. They don't know how to de-escalate situations. So they're taking sort of the beat policemen and putting them in a school without the proper training and without the proper coordination with educators, and it can be a real disaster. And that's where we've seen the worst situation. I think Judith Brown testified about this at the hearing that the Senate held in the Judiciary Committee about a kindergarten girl who had a tantrum in her classroom, was brought into the principal's office where she still had a tantrum, but eventually she calmed down. The police officers would call for a kindergarten girl. She was sitting calmly when they entered the room, but what did they do? They handcuffed her, brought her out, put shackles on her, sat her in the police car until her parents arrived. That is the kind of excessive use of an entanglement with law enforcement, and that's just one of the thousands of examples we're seeing across the country.
Damon Schneider, let's bring you in. You look at cultural, intellectual, and physical elements that contribute to this problem.
One of the things that I try to look at is the rationale and the reasoning behind these various policies and curriculum changes that have taken place. And what I found is, for example, in Los Angeles County, is that as rates of suspensions have gone down, what's taken place is that schools themselves have been more turned into these sites of extreme enclosures, whereby students may not be suspended off campus, but are sent into particular rooms and literally do nothing at all throughout the course of the day. So my research goes back from the 1940s and 50s to the current period, and schools have been a primary site of resistance and organizing that groups such as the Black Panther Party use high schools such as Jefferson and Fremont as key sites. And so then school police and LAPD and the sheriffs were first put in place in these schools in order to try to make sure that these efforts of resistance did not take place by and large. And so what I'm finding, in fact, is that the technologies of control that are in place right now in prisons were first used in schools and then exported out to prisons as these sites of enclosure.
Anthony Nocella, let's bring you in. You've talked also about these five S's. What are they and how do they relate to this?
Going off of what Damien was noting, I think we have to look at two major facets and issues that many people, when discussing, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline and issues around the school-to-prison pipeline, don't like to discuss, which is racism and as well as poverty. And I think that has a great deal to do with the current prison industrial complex, which many people discuss, as well as Michelle Alexander's new book, and a variety of other individuals have discussed that. And then poverty. And how do those two elements play into the rise of the school-to-prison pipeline? So I really want to get back to that issue and how complex the school system is not addressing that, be it in our curriculum, in our lesson plans, or just in how we construct the school and the community involvement within school. Who owns the school, and where are the teachers from, and what are the identities of these teachers? And I think that's really important as well. Going back to the five S's, I created a design, very simple for the students in the School of Education, to get an idea of what's going on today. And we're talking about the rise in overpopulation and overrepresentation of students of color, specifically African-American students, within special ed. The five S's are fairly simple. We're looking at special ed, stigmatization, segregation, and then we look at actual, you know, them getting arrested. And once we look at how these students are being pushed out, first being put into special ed and then put into segregation through that special ed, but how do they get into special ed? They need an IEP, which is individualized education programs. And an IEP is very hard to shake. I should know, I was in special ed from first to 12th grade, and then I was in segregated schools. And it was very difficult to feel confident about myself while I have this massive stigma of being different. And I think now not only are these students are oppressed because of their poverty or their race, but they're also now thinking differently, supposedly. And I think we need to address this problem, why so many teachers, which is predominantly white teachers in the United States, 97% of the teachers in Minnesota are white, 3% are teachers of color. And we have around 50% of the students graduating in the Twin Cities that are African American. This is an alarming rate that we need to address. So what is going on here? Are they leaving school? Or are they being pushed out? Are they, you know, getting kicked out? Are they leaving? Dropout versus push out concept. So I think these are some of the issues that we really need to talk about too.
All right. Well, let's bring Dan Lowson back in. You mentioned disability, and I didn't know if you were speaking of physical disability or if you're speaking of educational or learning disabilities. And now we've also been talking a little bit about special ed. Is this related?
Yeah. So what I was referring to are kids who are eligible for special education. So I agree with both the other two scholars that there is problems of racism and implicit bias. Oftentimes people think racism and they're saying, oh, you're accusing me of being like a Klan member. And I think what people fail to realize is that there's a whole range of racial bias where even people who would reject any concept of racism for themselves are still participating and they're not aware of it. So how they perceive, for example, behavior and whether or not they reach out to parents or give a kid a second chance can have everything to do with the race of the student and the race of the teacher. But I'd also point out that we have had principals like Joe Clark, African-American principal in East Patterson, who were notorious for trying to kick out all the bad kids in ways that were very not sound educationally. So one of the questions I think about structural racism as well. So where would we hire a person like a Joe Clark? I don't think you see principals like that being hired in the wealthier or whiter suburbs in America. Where do we tolerate that really harsh treatment of students, almost the criminalization of our youth, it's much more likely we'll hire leaders who have that sort of approach and attitude if they're working with racial minorities in urban settings than any other subgroup of the population.
Now, before we turn to looking at remedies and potential solutions to this problem, and it's very complex and very deep, unfortunately, we won't be able to get to everything, I wanted Damian Schneider to go back to you for a moment because of the aspects of the intellectual and cultural issues that have been coming up, for example, and they're embedded in the structure. So funding for particular kinds of music programs or funding for particular kinds of library books. You've researched this. What have you found?
If you go back to Nixon's administration in terms of being a president of the United States and his education policy of a nation at risk, which systematically tries to get rid of public education, that was his call for his campaign for president. From that point forward, what you see is a systemized process of testing, which manifests wholeheartedly in the Bush administration of No Child Left Behind and is continued under the Obama administration, which links test scores and that take charter schools. Now, what has happened is that a lot of money has been put in order for schools to be able to perform at a high rate with these tests. And as a result, a lot of the other school outlets, such as music or art, so on and so forth, in particular in schools which are not doing well, just happen to be black and brown schools as well, these programs have been completely cut out of the school altogether. And once again, going back to this aspect of being autonomous and having the ability to dictate what happens in your own schools, it's largely tied to these forms of music, art, so on and so forth. And so when this process happens, of course, then the schools become more and more just forms of what I call pedagogical incapacitation, where literally nothing is going on, nothing is being taught, and the students just go there for the sake of having to go there. But all forms of resistance have been cut down as a result.
Well, let's turn now to how can a system, a society, address these issues where schools are thought ideally to be a place where students can develop their potential, where they develop a future for a society or a country or a state that is really hopeful and prosperous in all areas of human development. So how do we get from here to there? I think, Anthony, we've left you out for a little bit, so why don't we start with you? One of the things you talk about is this issue of transformative justice. How does that fit in here?
Well, I think we have to see throughout society that we're engaged in a culture that promotes and fosters discipline that is grounded and rooted in punitive and retributive measures. That goes with the teachers, the teacher assistants, the principals, police officers, our parents, etc. And we have to start figuring out transformative healing and transformative justice ways, which takes into consideration one's identity. So if we are at a mediation or a peer mediation, if it's in a school or in a community mediation, we're not just bringing two people together and calling one a victim and one an offender, while the offender might be a huge transnational corporation that is sucking jobs out of a small town. We have to address that issue as well. So maybe a 14-year-old kid graffitied on this wall of this corporation, but what's making this kid do that? Well, it might be that their parents are having to do 15 different jobs to make ends meet because their job that they had before this corporation came into their town or their city was actually paying them a decent living wage. So I think we have to really complicate things when we look at justice, and we also have to look at how these schools are structured with metal detectors within them. We have to take the metal detectors out. We have to take the security guards out. We have to take much of these retributive and punitive systems out if we really want education to occur. If we don't want education to occur and we want it to be repressive and we want to force kids into incarceration at an alarming rate since the 1990s to now, which is becoming very, very profitable in the private, the nonprofit, and the state sector with incarcerating kids or putting them in non-secure and secure facilities. Having worked in secure facilities and now working with youth and volunteering in secure facilities in the Twin Cities, I can see that about 97% of the kids that are incarcerated in Minneapolis or in Hennepin County are kids of color. There is a direct correlation on how we're treating kids in school versus the same kids that are being incarcerated. And in some, I think we need a new justice system. It can't be reformed. It needs to be completely transformed or done away with. It's based on a very much slave and master narrative. And if we look at the 13th Amendment, we can see that it's institutionalized slavery only when somebody has been convicted of a crime. So we have about 2.5 million slaves in the United States right now. And I think that needs to be addressed as well.
You know, I want to ask you for just a second, because of what just happened in the East Coast with the shooting that occurred, in terms of the idea of metal detectors and those kinds of securities. Now, they had some like that at that school, and yet the kid that went and shot up the school forced his way in by shooting. How do you balance these issues? And I understand what you're saying is we need an entire transformation in the society, which I think everybody on this panel would agree with. But in the meantime, how do you protect six-year-olds?
This is Dan Lowson. It's often difficult when something like a school shooting like that or Columbine is the sort of driving force behind any change, because many of those things are difficult to prevent at the school security level. And it's really in that issue, and certainly in Columbine, you know, earlier intervention with supports for kids and mental health may or may not have helped. It's just a tragedy all around. And especially the fact that someone breaks into a school and kills all these children. It's just horrific. But I think on a daily basis, what we really need to think about is what the other folks have been talking about, is how we frame what we do around discipline, and discipline should be part of an educational mission and educational message. So the message has to be, we care about you, we want to improve your behavior, and not the personification, I would call, of our schools. Instead, we need to develop much more training for teachers to heavily engage with their students, have trusting relationships with them and their families, and that requires oftentimes a greater attention to multicultural differences and sensitivity. In schools, the research that is coming out that we'll be actually featuring in a major conference we have in D.C. on January 10th will show that the classroom management programs that really bolster and help teachers learn how to develop better trusting and engaged relationships with their students and their families actually not only reduce the use of out-of-school suspensions, but also reduce them more for kids of color. Research in Chicago suggests that the school climates serving kids from the most dangerous communities, usually racially and socioeconomically isolated neighborhoods, those schools, when they are strong on trust and engagement, they are as safe as the wealthiest schools in the Chicago area. So there's quite a bit to be said about developing more sense of trust and engagement and less of this sort of high security, turning our schools more and more into prisons.
What is the first step that we go towards this path?
So I would say training teachers and leaders and providing more supports for teachers and leaders in working with students and their families, and also bringing in things, systemic change and restorative practices, which comes off from Native American sort of philosophy where kids are held accountable but are absolutely important to keep them part of the community. And so that it's not punitive, but it's really looking at both the relationship of the student to the community, as well as improving or helping the student who has maybe done something that has violated the codes of conduct, and in a way that's supportive and constructive. So it's a much more rehabilitative kind of sensibility and much more inclusive, rather than this idea we're going to kick you out onto the streets where you're unsupervised. And those methods don't work. And economically, they make no sense whatsoever.
Damien Schneider.
In response to your previous question, I think there's three main things that could be done, have to be done, in order to change the system, just for the short term. The first is to get rid of testing.
You mean standardized testing?
Standardized testing, exactly. Exactly. That has to go. That has to be top of the agenda. The second is to get rid of all forms of formal and informal policing on campuses. And in many schools have many levels, tiers of policing. It could be a county sheriff, the city, the school district policing, and then staff members as well. All that has to go as well. And then the third thing is that there has to be understanding that there is lots of money within public education, but where that money is going has to be tracked and systematically changed as well, so that members of the school neighborhood and community have not only access but have say as to where all of those funds are being spent, and then we'll be able to dictate what the school looks like with that money as well.
You know, I'm still struggling a little bit given all the school shootings that are going on with wanting to go past the policing and not have that in the future, but removing it right away before we've really transformed a society is a little bit frightening, I think, for a lot of parents.
I think the thing to understand is that once all these measures are put in place, it's found that schools actually are more dangerous. So it's counterintuitive to what you normally would think. So, for example, when the DARE program was first put in place here in Los Angeles, drug usage rates actually went up instead of going down within schools. In large part, it's going back to what members of the panel were saying, is that you have people who are not trained to work with youth are using very draconian measures. There's automatic resistance against that in any form, way, shape, or possible. So the moment that you put in these measures saying you can't do this, you can't do that, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, what you're going to have is resistance to that just naturally because you're telling youth that they can't do something and not explaining what it is at all. So there has to be a much more holistic approach which involves members of a neighborhood, members of the community to come and come up with solutions themselves as opposed to just imposing these very harsh norms upon schools.
Anthony, let's finish up with you. And in your final comments here, I'd like to hear a little bit about your experience with the Alternative to Violence Project and how that affected the youth you were working with.
Well, I would first say, before going to the AVP, Alternative to Violence Project, that started in Greenhaven Prison in the 1970s to eliminate some of the riots and unjust behavior that was going on by the prisons towards the insiders. It's conflict transformation, and some people from the outside and some people from the inside came together to develop group building and conflict transformation workshops to deal more constructively with different gangs, as well as between insiders, as well as meaning prisoners and correction officers, and how to develop a more constructive relationship. So there are programs in the community, and I think that would be number one. Get the community involved. Make sure that the schools, and I think, you know, hip-hop and hip-hop studies and hip-hop culture really speaks to that, is that until schools are teaching something that is useful for the kids, like surviving, like handling police brutality, like making sure your heat is on in the winter, those kind of issues, then school is really not important to a lot of youth, specifically in the urban community. And hip-hop speaks to that over and over again for the last 15 years. Yeah, almost every political album has spoken to that issue. So I would think that schools need to start addressing community needs, and then the school's only going to be able to address communities if the community's involved. And I think, as somebody recently said on this show, is that I think we need to start getting teachers and administrators and principals and superintendents involved in training. And I think the number one form of training is listening. They do a lot of talking, but they don't do a lot of listening to the community members and seeing what they need. And once they do that, I think that's where they need to start sharing the power of education and making sure that education is really multicultural. Right now, it's not. And I think it's only focusing on one dominant culture.
Well, Anthony Nutella, Dan Lowson, and Damian Schneider, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from scholarcircle.org. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.